under King Rezin and northern Israel under Pekah, son of Remaliah, had been forced to become a part of the Assyrian Empire. And they are putting intense pressure on Judah to join them in their Brexit plan, you know, to gain independence from Assyria. Now, verse 2 tells us that the people of Judah are scared to death. They are at the overwhelming threat to their survival. You might think of this. This is their personal Gethsemane. Remember Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane facing an overwhelming threat. And maybe you've experienced that in, you know, in terms of personal health crisis or relational crisis or financial crisis. They are in deep doo-doo, we might say. And they wonder, in the midst of that, what are we supposed to do? And the Lord sends them the prophet Isaiah, his messenger, and his son Shir Yashub to pay Ahaz a personal pastoral visit. And they go to meet Ahaz at the city aqueduct, which is where he is trying to secure the above-ground water supply that comes into the city because he knows there's a coming siege and he's wanting to try to get as much water together as he can beforehand. And God's message through the prophet Isaiah is really very simple. Be careful to keep calm and don't be afraid. The basic root of that word, keep calm, is tranquility. It implies the absence of worry or anxiety. God in the Bible repeatedly tells his people to find rest in him. In other words, don't stress yourself out mentally. Don't wear yourself out physically. But Ahaz had plenty on his mind, and he had a long to-do list. He was determined to try and negotiate his way out of the crisis by making a deal with Assyria. And we often, in midst of crisis, can live and act as if everything is depending on me and my abilities. And that's one of the reasons why we can become overwhelmed. What am I supposed to do, right? What am I supposed to do? And we think that is the normal way of living. That's a viable option. And yet Isaiah says that way of life is not a viable option. It is a dead end. And he says the source of your current threat is really, you know, you think they're big and overwhelming. They're really two mere human beings in the scope of things. They kind of thought of themselves as big firebrands, we might say. And Isaiah, God calls them smoldering stubs. Or as I like to put it, dim wicks. Dimwicks, yes. Okay. And he says through the prophet Isaiah there, in the short term, their threatened invasion, not going to happen. And in the not so distant future, in fact, their land will be utterly decimated, laid waste. He says to Ahaz, your only hope really is to trust in God. Otherwise, you're toast. That's the history lesson here for us. And he's saying, really, trust in the promise of God, because as the king in the line of David, God had given David a great promise that he would always have a ruler on the throne, a descendant upon the throne. And then this promise was passed down to the next one in line like a great inheritance. And we see it actually in Ahab in 2 Chronicles is talking to Jeroboam in the north. And he says to him, he's basically bullying him. And he reminds him of this promise. He says, don't you know that the Lord, the God of Israel, has given the kingship of Israel to David and his descendants forever by a covenant of salt? And a covenant of salt, they would put salt into the covenant because that was a preservative. And it was a symbol that this was a promise that would be preserved, that would last a long time. And he's saying, trust in what God has said. That's where you should be putting your focus, not on the magnitude of your problems. And he offers a sign to strengthen and support this faith in verse 11. And indeed, King Ahaz is given the opportunity to choose any sign of his liking that will provide the evidence he feels that he needs to strengthen his wavering faith in the current crisis. And I mean, it was wavering faith. The image in verse 2 was that people were feeling shaken as if by a mighty wind. Right? And Ahaz's response, it seems rather unexpected. Here he's got a great opportunity. God, show me that you're there. Show me that you're going to help me through this crisis. And Ahaz says, I don't really need it. I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. It sounds very spiritual. I'm good to go, but it isn't. He's refusing because he's refusing to let God put himself to the test to illustrate his dependability. I think of it when I used to go out looking for work, especially when I was a summer, looking for my first job. I wanted somebody to just give me an opportunity. Let me prove myself that I'm reliable, that I can do the job, right? Give me the opportunity and I'll show you. And if they said, no, we don't need you, right? They weren't even giving me the opportunity. And Ahaz isn't even giving God the opportunity here because God said, just give me opportunity, I will show you that you can totally trust me. And yet despite Ahaz's refusal, that's because Ahaz, he doesn't want to hear what God's plan is because he's got his own plan and he's really deeply committed to it. And yet despite his refusal, Ahaz and the people are given a sign, a messianic sign. That is a sign of this great, the hero that God was promising all along. And he says that the virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. It's important first to hear this in the original context because there is a very clear basic timeline and purpose in this child sign that is clear, even if the identity is not clear. You see, here Isaiah foretells the utter defeat of the two kings currently threatening Ahaz, a defeat that will happen in the not-so-distant future. Now, not so distant, because first there was time needed for the virgin to be pregnant, and then there's this 9-month period approximately, right, before the baby is born. And then there's time needed for the child to grow up, but Isaiah says, not like growing to maturity, before he really knows right and wrong. So it's within a couple of years. And we might wonder, who is this child that Isaiah has in mind? Some have wondered, well, did Ahaz think that it was, one of his wives that was, he's going to get married and have a child? It's possible. But it's interesting. I think it's probably one of Isaiah's. Because if we flip forward the next chapter, right away, one of Isaiah's children is used as a sign. And then near the end of the chapter, he says, here I am, the children the Lord has given me. We are signs and symbols in Israel from the Lord Almighty who dwells on Mount Zion. You see, Isaiah's name itself means the Lord saves. So you think of it. The Lord saves is here to see you, Ahaz. You get the idea, like as a billboard, right? A sign. And then his kids, he names them interesting names. Shir Yeshuv means a remnant will return. That was, you're not going to be totally cleared out. There's going to be a remnant. And his other son is a little longer. Maher Shal Hashbaz. Say that 3 times. Maher Shal Hashbaz. Means quick to the plunder, swift to the booty. It means these guys are going to be taken care of really quickly. So you think every time he comes in, swift to the plunder, quick to the booty, is here to see you, right? It's these messages, right? They're signs, they're symbols. And that's why Emmanuel, God is with us, is here to see you. You get the significance. It's like you can't miss it, right? And there was a fulfillment of this sign in Isaiah's day. What Isaiah predicted in the short term did indeed happen. We don't know exactly which child it was that was the significant one. I think it was one of Isaiah's kids. But Matthew, 700 years after the fact, when he gets the message about Jesus, okay, and the message that Joseph is given, the virgin will conceive, that is Mary, and will give birth to a son. He's saying, you know what? That original promise was fulfilled then, but there's even a bigger, it was pointing to even a bigger salvation that was going to be brought. That was local for Ahaz and the people of that time, but the global crisis that we're in requires a global solution. And this is the global solution. In Jesus, God has become present in a new and deeper way. Not just present through his spirit like he was in the Old Testament. Not just present through a personal representative that he empowered like in Isaiah and others. No, this time he's really coming in person. God with us in all of the fullness of what that means. And actually, Jesus, in one of his parables in Matthew 21, he tells the story of a landowner who built a vineyard and then rented out this elaborate vineyard to some farmers. And when harvest time came, Jesus said, he sent some of his servants to the tenants to collect his portion of the rent, if you will, his share. But rather than pay up, the tenants beat one servant, killed the other, and stoned a third. So the landowner sent other servants, but they treated them exactly the same way. So finally, the landowner sent his son to them, thinking, surely they will respect my son. But when the tenants saw his son, they killed him. They thought, now we've got the run of the place to ourselves. Now, there is more to this parable, but we can see that Jesus was telling them that he was that son. Desperate times require desperate measures, we say, right? How desperate we must be to need God himself to come in person. You know, when I was growing up, sometimes there would be trouble at home. Sometimes I would be the cause of that. And then my mother would give this line. You know, she would do some discipline, but she would say, wait till your father comes home. Yeah, desperate times require desperate solutions here. So it is telling us about how deeply we needed rescue. And Philippians, I love Philippians chapter 2. Because in Philippians chapter 2, Paul gives us this window. Many think it is an early Christian hymn, a song that they sang, because it encapsulated the wonder, the reality of God coming in person. And he says, in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Jesus Christ. What's that? Well, who, being in very nature, in essence, God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing. By taking the very nature, the very form of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even the humiliation of death on a cross. 1 John 3:16, which is kind of similar to John 3:16, but 1 John 3:16, this letter, he says, this is how we know what love is. It's a letter that talks a lot about love, but it always defines it. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. He is Emmanuel, who brings us God's love. Okay. So, if Jesus came to reveal God to us in person, then what do we learn about God? What must God be like if he, through the incarnation, that's the Greek word for coming in the flesh, flesh and blood, right? The real deal, not a hologram or a virtual reality, the real deal. And a word that immediately comes to mind what God must be like, he must be humble. One writer has suggested that the cry of the Muslims, Allah Akbar, heard that, right? God is great. That is a truth which no supernatural being needs to teach us. But that God is humble, that is the truth which Jesus alone taught us. The God who the prophet Amos described God as a roaring lion. And the God who Isaiah said could order armies and empires around like pawns on a chessboard. This God emerged in Bethlehem as a baby who could not speak or eat solid food or control even his bladder, who depended on a teenager for survival, for food and love. That's humble. And in his incarnation, God shows us that he is approachable. Those of us raised in a tradition of informal or private prayer may not appreciate the change that Jesus brought in how human beings approach deity, the divine. Hindus offer sacrifices at the temple. Kneeling Muslims, see them, they bow so low that the forehead is right on the ground, right? In most religious traditions, in fact, fear rather than love is the primary emotion by which one approaches God. And we find this sense of reverence of God in the pages of the Old Testament as well. Yet, among a people who walled off the most holy place for God in the temple and who made sure that they never pronounced the name that God had given to them or misspelt it, God made a surprising appearance as a baby in a stable. Nothing demonstrated God's humility and accessibility like the newborn child wrapped in simple strips of cloth lying in a manger. That's the way peasants, the point is, this is the way peasants, you know, care for their children. They would collect scraps and wrap them in swaddling clothes, strips of linen, strips of cloth lying in a manger. I mean, that's why the shepherds, they could go there. If you've ever been to a place that is way above, you know, the status of what you're used to being in, right? You kind of feel like, whoa, intimidated, right? I don't know if I really belong here. And yet, Jesus is born in a place where it communicated. You know, not only through the angels, but you're going to find him lying in a manger. He's going to be one that's right at your level. He is totally accessible to you, and you are welcome. And yet, Matthew tells us that even kings, wise men from the East, internationals, are gathering to see the birth of the child that has been written in the heavens itself. The Magi were those who studied the movements of the stars, and they knew something big was happening by the alignment of certain planets and a star. And they came to see it for themselves. I think some of the other applications, maybe of the implications of God being humble and approachable, is that God is with us in all of life, including the crisis of life. As he was with Ahaz and the people in their crisis. Desperate times call, not just for desperate measures, they call for greater dependence and reliance upon God. And I have thought about different times in my life, how in the midst of crisis times, often I have needed a sign or something that reminds me in the present that God, you're in this. You know, you're not giving up. You are with me. You are present in the midst of it. One that I've shared before, when our youngest son, who was conducting here, Ryan, when he was just born and he spent his first 40 days and nights in children's hospital, you know, on life support, and when we finally got to take him home, you know, on 40 days and 40 nights, we had been walking past a rainbow painted on the entrance to the neonatal unit every day. And we realized, yeah, God, there's this sign. It was only on the 40th day. It's like, God, you get the connection here, you know? I'm with you in this. I'm with you. I don't know what the crisis may be that you are in. Maybe the crisis is, how am I going to handle some of the relatives if they actually show up for Christmas? And it's different to demand a sign from God. God, I won't believe you unless you do this. The Bible doesn't, you know, say that's a good thing. That's not a good thing. But it's kind of like the guy in one of the Gospels. He said, oh, Jesus, I do believe, but help me overcome my unbelief. And God, he's a God who gives a sign, often something very personalized for us in the midst of it. And so, finally, I want to encourage you to look and listen for signs of God's presence. Because Jesus, when he left physically this earth, he says, "Behold, I am with you sometimes." No? What do you say? "Behold, I am with you." Let's try. "Behold, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." That's a promise. Just like Ahaz should have been banking on that great inheritance, this promise that had been passed down, Jesus gives his followers this great inheritance, this great promise. Not that everything will be solved instantly or exactly the way that we want, but he's saying, "You'll never be alone. I will be with you." I remember being in the midst of a crisis and we were singing a song, "Your grace is enough." And I couldn't sing it, because I was feeling, "I don't believe it. It feels, God, like your grace isn't enough." And I sensed God saying, "Then ask for more. Because I want you to know that my grace is enough. And it's okay to just be honest and say, I don't feel like it's enough." And so I encourage you, look and listen for signs of God's presence along the way. His track record is that he gives those. He gives ways of reassuring so that his people can continue to trust him in the midst of life. Because desperate times require greater dependence upon him. And he came to demonstrate to us that he is a God who can be fully trusted. Not a God who is distant and detached, but a God who cares deeply about us. He has thrown in his lot with us. He allowed his son to be put to death on the cross for us to restore our relationship to him. That is good news, friends. As the team comes up for the closing song, let us bow and pray together. Oh, God of the universe, we thank you that you demonstrated that you are the great God, but you are the great God who shows his greatness also in great humility and in great approachability. We thank you that you came as Emmanuel, who brings us God's love, not as a package sent across by couriers, but as one who comes in person, in the flesh and blood, that we might know that we are never alone, and that your grace is great, and that you are the one who is to be forever praised. Amen.